Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
And, you know, with Okapi, they're solitary. So you're lucky if you find one, and then it's just that.
What can they teach us?
So they have these things called ossicones, which are two skin-covered horns on their head.
Many species are in crisis and need your help.
Organization. So you can find them at www.okapiconservation.org. They were established a little over 30 years ago.
Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
All right, welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
Hello, Angie. Today is a beautiful summer day in New Zealand.
And it's a beautiful summer day in Gainesville, Florida.
Is it?
It is.
Summer. It's winter.
I know.
There.
Well, we're already, not that you remember Fahrenheit anymore, but we're already in 80 degree weather here. It's a little premature, but I'll take it over
almost,
cold weather.
Yeah, almost spring there. So that's the thing about Florida. One day it's, you know, 20 degrees F, and then the next day it's 80. Yeah. It's
just,
don't miss that. Yeah, don't miss that. So today we're talking about a really amazing mammal.
Beautiful and unusual okapi.
Yeah, and the cool thing is about this one when we decided to do it was this was actually like one of the first zoo animals I ever really got to interact with and touch and feel and feed with my wife when she was working as a keeper. This was one of her animals that she got to work with, and it was just an amazing experience.
Wow. You know, I agree. We're going to describe them here, but they're just beautiful animal. I don't know how else to say it. Everybody who knows me knows I'm biased because I love hoofs and horns.
Yeah.
I love ungulates, of course. But they just, they're nicknamed either the forest giraffe or the zebra giraffe because they literally have the best of both worlds going on as far as body shape and coat patterns. And they're just cool. They're shy and secretive and elegant. I didn't get a chance to work with them when I was a keeper, but I have had a chance to interact with them at some local conservation places here in Florida. So I've been up close and personal, and they're just breathtaking. So when I was preparing for this podcast, as I normally do, I read a lot, but I'll find myself watching some videos.
Right.
And there was a video of some okapi. I think it was at maybe the Columbus Zoo, I'm not sure. And it was a wonderful documentation of how the keepers were training a pregnant okapi for an ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
All voluntary contact. The okapi's just standing there, eating some treats with the keeper, training it and telling it to stay quietly. And then the veterinarian comes in with the ultrasound probe and just puts it on the okapi's belly. And then you look on the ultrasound screen and you can see the bones and the tissue of this baby okapi. And I don't know, Chris, for the first time in a long time, I was like, oh my gosh, I need to go back and be a hoof stock keeper. I was just like, I miss it so much. I was just like, that is what I want to be doing today and tomorrow.
Not
and
writing.
and every day of my life. And I think about being, you know, missing those. I miss the animals I used to work with every day, but just that connection of helping save a highly endangered large mammal like that. I mean, the keeper staff and veterinarian staff at the zoo are doing incredibly important work. And I was just longing, really, really longing to be a part of that a little bit more hands-on aspect of animal care.
Well, here you go, Angie. Just keep writing, finish out your dissertation, graduate this spring, become Dr. Adkin, and then you could be out there doing the ultrasounds.
I know,
and the keepers can be holding it for you, right?
I'd rather be the one feeding it, though. I love feeding animals.
I know. It's fun. So, they're really docile, really great to handle, really great to work with. You know, we're going to have an interview with somebody that has worked with these animals before coming up.
My dream job, the okapi keeper.
Yes, and he has worked very closely with these animals, and he's going to give us some insight on that. So just to give a description, if you haven't seen an okapi, and from what Angie's been saying, you know, really people thought, and it's funny when you listen to people outside an okapi enclosure for the first time, they're like, oh, is it a giraffe or is it a zebra? because it has, like Angie said, the qualities of both. You have this really mini giraffe. You know, it still stands 7, 8, 9 feet tall at the head, only about 5 feet at the shoulder, or 1.5 meters at the shoulder, but it still kind of looks like a giraffe. You know, it has a long neck, not as long as a giraffe's, but still pretty big. And
it's it's disproportionate to its body, where you're like, oh, right. It's a long neck.
Yeah, not like a horse with a long neck. This thing's like a long neck. And the zebra part comes in because they have this amazing striping in their hind end, like striping patterns on a zebra, and their front legs. It's just gorgeous. Black and white striping.
And it's beautiful, and similar to zebras, it's like a fingerprint. The stripes are unique to each okapi.
Right, right. And then their top coat and the coat around their barrel, their neck, and their face is this reddish brown, dark brown.
And in some lights, it can almost look maroon.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy.
That's pretty cool.
The coat on this is beautiful. So please, you know, look at the show notes. You can see, you know, right up there, the picture of this animal. It's just gorgeous. They're just gorgeous. And then they also have these huge ears, too.
Yeah. So, oh, my gosh, Chris. I was just going to say that. Like, it's silly to focus on an animal's ears, but these are some of the most beautiful ears, I think, in the animal kingdom. They're big and they're round, and they can actually manipulate them so they can move one at a time in order to listen to different sounds on one side or the other. And it's just... they're just beautiful, man.
Right, right. They are.
And their faces, they have this dark coat, chocolate, reddish brown over most of their body, but then their faces are lighter and almost have a little bit of whitish in it too. So when they just turn around and look at you, it's just this really cool animal.
Yeah, and those ears are just critical for catching sound waves, right? That directs it into the inner ear so they can detect, you know, people, predators, and everything. And that's where they have this name called the elusive okapi, or even some people used to call them the African unicorn because they didn't believe it existed.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The okapi is from deep in the Congo, or it was first discovered in the Ituri forest in today Congo, or the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Which was formerly known as Zaire years ago.
Right. Right. And so this was actually one of the last large megafauna ever to be discovered. So out of all the species of large mammal, unless there's one out there that we haven't found yet.
Right. Maybe there is.
Yeah. But this was the last big one because it was so hard to find. You know, imagine these deep, deep forests where people hadn't been. So it's really interesting listening to how these animals were discovered. So in Africa, they were known from the local indigenous people that there was this animal for thousands of years. They knew it existed.
Yeah, the indigenous people always know these things. It's more the it's more the Westerners that need to get caught up.
Right, right. And so so the early explorers heard about this mythical creature, and the story goes with one of the local tribes, and this was the late 1800s, and they described this creature and they called it an Ati. So A-T-T-I. And in their language, it meant donkey. So they thought, they were saying, oh, what's this creature? And they're like, oh, it's Ati, like your donkey that they were using to carry their supplies. And then in 1901, Sir Harry Johnston, when he was exploring Central Africa, he was actually given the skin or this crazy coat that we just described, and a skeleton of the okapi, and they were finally able to describe this animal, but still had not seen a live one yet.
And it's
still elusive.
Still elusive. And what I think is kind of interesting about this story is that Harry Johnston, which years later the okapi scientific name would be named after, he was the British governor of Uganda at the time, and he had found out that some not so nice people were exploiting local indigenous pygmy people that were native to the region.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry thought this was very inappropriate. And so he rescued the local pygmies and returned them to their homes and deep in the into the villages of what is now the Congo. And they were very grateful for this. And they are one of the ones that mostly confirmed the rumors and said, yes, this is, there is this animal out there that's big and unique and very elusive. And so he was, right. you know, he was one of the first ones then to actually send back the remains of a carcass to London. So then right. The Western world could be enlightened about this new creature, and it caused a huge media sensation. Even back in the early 1900s, that the world was just in shock that they hadn't known about this. And so, yeah, a lot of it's thanks to this Henry Johnston and him wanting to help people, and then of course the native people appreciating that, and then sharing this really cool, you know, donkey unicorn or whatever, you know, sharing it with them and saying, yes, you know, you're not crazy. There really is this big mammal that you guys don't know about.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. I mean, you know, for thousands of years, going back to Roman times, I mean, they knew all these big creatures from Africa that they were imported into Europe. Zoos were always a big thing for hundreds of years, you know, putting animals on display. So here you have this large, large mammal.
Gorgeous. That no one knew about. Unique. Yeah.
So you can imagine in the 1900s, it'd be like, oh my God, look at this thing. So you're right. So it was named after him, and it's the scientific name is Okapi Johnstoni.
Very so good. Very. That's an easy, fun one. Okapi Johnstoni.
Yes.
Even I can say that one. And,
yeah. And then just to kind of wrap it up again on how they were found. So in 1909, Americans went in there, did catch some live ones, babies that died. So, you know, that's not great. But they finally did.
I know, Chris. Why are you bringing the podcast down?
I know. I'm sorry. But the first one was brought into captivity in 1919 in the Antwerp Zoo. So they were the first ones able to bring it into captivity and keep it alive. And we are where we are today. So, you know, a really neat mammal that we're talking about today. And, you know, it's kind of interesting, their conservation. Why should we care? Why do we care about this animal?
Well, I mean, for me, number one, just take a look at them. They're just so beautiful. And I know I'm going to say that over and over on this podcast today, but they're just really striking and pleasing to the eye. And they're so rare and unique. And most recently, you know, to the Western world, recently discovered, yet known by the locals within the region for centuries. And to this day, the okapi definitely is the cultural symbol of the Congo. And the okapi is also considered an umbrella species in this really beautiful and immense biodiversity of the forest. Because if you can protect the okapi, right, because they're so awesome and you want to protect them, you're also going to protect elephants, chimpanzees, and gorillas. So some other megafauna that happen to live in the area.
That's interesting you say that as being a flagship species, and I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, the trickle up and trickle down. That's kind of a constant theme you and I go back and forth about. And so if you're right, if you pour resources into protecting this one species in that region, you're protecting a whole bunch of other species, because that part of the world is just, a lot of these animals are under extreme threat. You know, getting my elephant plug in, forest elephants in this part of the world are getting slaughtered for their tusks. So there's a lot of instability and war in the region. And so if we're able to protect, you know, pour resources into, you know, a flagship species that people want to save, you know, think about all the frogs. You know, we talked about frogs, you know, a few podcasts ago, and in the future we'll talk about other species, you know, the species that people don't think about.
Well, and the forest, because the okapi need the forest, and we'll get more into their nutrition in the podcast, but they eat they browse on the plant foliage. And so these areas that are preserving the okapi are also preserving immense amounts of rainforest.
Right.
So a lot of plant species, a lot of frogs, a lot of insects, and then, of course, a lot of larger mammals like the elephants and gorillas.
Right.
So, it's really something we can get behind, at least that I can get behind, and hopefully learning more about their unique physiology, and we'll get the listeners more excited and wanting to help these guys, or at least recognize them at a zoo and saying, you know, oh, yeah, you know, they're really cool.
Yeah. I remember that podcast. I know all about them. So talk a little bit more about their background. The Okapi giraffes are from the same family. They're both even-toed ungulates. Now, Angie did say she loves ungulates, but her favorite is the odd-toed, the single-toed generally. The horses and rhinos are Angie's babies. But I can do
some even-toed too.
Yeah. Anything with hoof and horns, right?
Mm-hmm. I can do some Erisodactyls. Yeah.
Even-toed ungulates, generally you think of like cows and the cloven hoof, goats, sheep, they have two toes. And actually reading some of the history on the Okapi, the early explorers knew there was this large cloven-hoofed animal. That's why it was so mythical, because they saw their tracks. But, the huge tracks, not little deer tracks or little antelope tracks. It was huge tracks, and then they knew there was some sort of large creature there. Now, the Okapis belongs to the family of Giraffidae, and only the Okapi and giraffes are the ones remaining. Now, it's interesting, the Okapi and giraffes have some things that are in common. They both have 7 cervical vertebrae, but the giraffe neck is much longer.
Obviously. Much longer, much, much longer.
Yeah, we'll do giraffes this year. We'll have to do giraffes this year because their physiology is incredible. But Okapi is very similar, right? So they have these things called ossicones, which are 2 skin-covered horns on their heads. Generally, the males, Angie will get into some of the differences of the males and females. Females do have bumps. And then they both have dark-colored tongues, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, and what's interesting with the ossicones is that if you think of horns, which, of course, we've talked about on this podcast, in antelope or in cattle species, those are actually derived from bone. But ossicones are derived from ossified cartilage rather than living bone. So that's why it's a little different. And they're covered with skin, like Chris said, instead of fur or like velvet in the antlers.
Yeah.
So somewhat different, but very similar to what's found in giraffes.
Yeah, and if you haven't heard the reindeer episode, Angie goes into crazy detail about antlers, but it's so awesome. It is like such an amazing mammal adaptation.
It's the coolest one out there. I mean, it's a lot of growth in a short period of time.
It's insane.
Just to score a babe.
Hell yeah, baby. Start growing. Like I said, I need to write a book on how males in the wild or how other mammals attract females. I'll be a millionaire.
I'm working on it. You will.
I'm going to work on it tonight.
It's so different than the human world where the women are the ones that have to do everything. I'm calling BS on that one.
All right. So getting back to Okapis.
Ossicones. We were at ossicones. Yes. The males have these little horns. The females, for the most part, they're absent. They have hair whorls, little bumps.
Just to kind of jump into some of their life cycle. Again, since they're elusive, not easy to study. You know, what we know from them is from captivity.
Right. It's really hard to track something in the woods that dense woods up in the elevation that's shy and elusive. It's only active diurnally and maybe and sometimes in the darkness. They migrate a lot. So, and they're solitary, right? So,
right.
The other thing, too, is a lot of times researchers have great luck in some of the different reserves in Africa studying giraffe and elephants because you can watch family dynamics and watch them interact with each other and what they do and who's dominant and who's not. And I think that with Okapi, they're solitary. So you're lucky if you find one and then it's just that one. So how it interacts with another Okapi during breeding season, which is the only time they come together, is not really been seen in the wild. I mean, still, to this day. That's where studying them in a captive setting is really helped researchers and scientists and zoologists understand more about how to help protect these guys. And how to help, and how to care for them too, of course, in a captive setting.
Right, because if you're in the deepest, darkest jungle you could imagine in Africa, you're in a region that's hard to get to. You're in a region that
very remote.
Right. Yeah. Pretty contentious, you know, off and on. This animal hears you way before you even know it's there. So it's going the opposite direction of you. And, you know,
yeah, it's
and
a
like
flight,
you said,
it's a flight animal. So it typically wants to flee from something it's scared of.
Right. It's extremely shy. And just recently they've discovered that they're diurnal. For a long time, they thought they were nocturnal and that's why you never saw them. But we know that's not true, right? That they actually are diurnal. Some of the things that they've been able to kind of track a little bit, some studies have shown the male territories could be greater than 10 square kilometers or 6 miles, but they tend to think that's about right. Overlaps with some female territories, so females are about half that, is from the one study I saw.
And males will migrate continuously, while females will tend to be somewhat sedentary.
Right.
And that, yeah, there are some, they can overlap, but typically they don't interact unless it's breeding season, male and female.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, it's just, you know, crazy. So, you know, I guess that's a good segue into kind of some of their behavior and what you could find. I mean, besides what we know in captivity.
Right. Well, and I think that's the beautiful thing about research and animal lovers out there like myself. I found when I was preparing for this podcast, I found myself, like I said, just watching the videos of them eating.
Right,
and I was
in
heaven. Yeah. Of course, herbivores, that's what they tend to do. They tend to eat most of the time.
Uh-huh.
Graze, or these guys browse. But yeah, because of diligent researchers and zookeepers and animal care staff members, we have learned a lot about them, and at least in a captive setting. And we know that they're essentially solitary. They come together to breed. It's been reported that grooming is a really common practice for okapi, and they'll focus on their neck. And when they groom themselves, they use their tongue, of course, as you would think a dog or a cat or something. And interestingly enough about the okapi, their tongue can be 18 inches long.
Wow.
So that's... I don't know the metrics on that off the top of my head, but it's a foot and a half, okay?
Yeah.
And that's a long tongue. And
yeah, that's
of course,
40 centimeters, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And of course, they evolved this tongue for a purpose, because that's what nature does. It does things with purpose, typically. And the purpose is so that they can reach leaves that are higher up, similar to a giraffe, or you use its neck to get different things that other animals can't specialize in.
Mm-hmm.
But they've also loved to use their tongue to clean themselves. And they are the only mammal that can use its tongue to clean its ears.
Yeah.
So they have really long faces, like giraffes or horses, kind of, if you can picture that, or zebras. So yeah, that tongue goes up to the eye.
That's crazy.
Cleans out the eye, keeps the flies away and whatnot. So yeah, it's pretty very cool adaptation.
Can you imagine licking your own ear? Oh my god!
It's a built-in Q-tip. Are you kidding me? I love it. I love the idea.
Disgusting. All that earwax. Yum. Oh.
But Chris, if you clean them out every day, there's not going to be that much earwax. So.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, the very, very talented okapi can do that.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And as Chris has hinted to earlier, it is a docile, tranquil animal, shy, people call it, along with being elusive. However, it is a hoofstock animal, and it has strong, powerful legs, and so it can kick out at the butt and use its head to show aggression when it needs to. And we also know, too, that the males will communicate with other males by marking territories with their urine, which is often common in hoofstock species.
Mm-hmm.
And the females have common defecation sites, or poop piles. Or if you're a zookeeper, that's your favorite animal, because it's super easy to clean up after, because they all poop in the similar spot.
Yeah, that reminds me. That reminds me that behavior. Like, I've never really seen it before with hoofstock. And I remember when you dragged me out, when we started all this fun stuff way back when, looking at Somali Wild Ass. And I have a video of hetero marking. So there was one of the female jennies, she went and pooped, And we're watching, you know, doing our behavior study. And I watch another one come by, sniff, and poop on the same spot. And I was like, what? Yep. What is going on? It's like dog, you know, dog marking. And I've mm-hmm. never saw that before. And I went back to my office and looked it up and realized that was one thing they do. And they think it might be to hide numbers from predators and stuff like that.
Okay. That
yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah. It was really crazy. Like I, yeah. So copy does that. That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The females do. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Another cool thing that they do that's different than most of the hoofstock that I've worked with or studied, but they will rub their necks against trees.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it leaves a brown extrudate, which
right.
is like a brown substance. And it probably, researchers don't know why. So there's an interesting job for whoever wants to answer it. But this brown kind of ooze is probably to mark their territory, right?
Right,
I presume, maybe.
And I also read, because I remember this, is interacting with the okapi, one of the things I got to do is, you know, pet it a little bit and pat it on the neck. And you walk
sure,
away
Chris,
and your hands are disgusting because of all
right.
that.
Mm-hmm,
yeah, of
mm-hmm.
all that sticky goo. And mm-hmm. what I did read is they kind of think it might help them stay waterproof with their coats.
That
right. might be
go ahead.
No, I'd say that may be one reason.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And I think the other thing I was going to ask you, I haven't got to touch one. And so you have that one up on me. Now I want to go rub on some okapi, man. They're,
yeah.
But I have to ask you, since you've had that privilege,
all right.
What minus the brown, you know,
sticky,
oozy
yeah.
stuff on your sticky stuff on your hands. But what did their coat feel like? Because I've heard it be described as short but velvet like.
Right. Yeah. That's what I remember. It's soft. It's.
Yeah.
This is going back. We're going back 10 years, 10-12 years. But it. Yeah, I remember it was pretty soft. Like it wasn't. It was not rough like some other hoofstock or even like a horse coat, you know, which I've done. It feels like a horse that had like a nice shampoo and conditioned and got like dried
like
really
silky,
nice.
Like, yeah,
yeah,
smooth and velvety. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Well, and of course, my favorite section or one of my favorite sections of this podcast is vocalizations.
Mm-hmm.
And okapi definitely communicate with each other. A lot of times females, when they're ready to breed, but their vocal cords are poorly developed compared to a lot of other hoofstock, maybe because they're like a living fossil.
Yeah.
But they three sounds that they commonly do make is called the chuff, and
mm-hmm.
that's a contact call that's used by both male and females. They also moan, so that's going to be
right.
the female during courtship, like, hey buddy, come on over here. So she moans. And then the infants, when they're under stress or they're not happy, they make a vocalization called a bleat.
Right.
Unfortunately, though, I'm not able to give you an example because there's
right.
not one out there for me to use that I have access to. So it goes to show that there's just not, you know, these guys are still very secretive. They're still, even though a fair amount are, you know, live under human care, there's still a lot that
we don't know.
We
right.
don't know or that isn't heard or fully understood.
Maybe I'll have Jesse mimic some sounds. But it's interesting, you know, you're talking about like, you know, they're primitive or they don't vocalize as much. And this is what I love about learning about all these new species. You think about it, they don't need to really vocalize, right? They don't want to vocalize.
Mm-mm.
They want to be just left alone. They don't want to highlight
mm-hmm.
themselves. So they haven't really had a
nope.
need to develop, you know, a rich vocabulary. So I bet you
they're not a herd. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're not a herd animal, so they don't need to be communicating with each other all the time. They only really need to be able to talk to each other, to find each other, to breed.
Maybe we need to find you
and then be on their merry way.
Find you some money for a postdoc, because I would be really. It would be awesome to study okapi social behavior, because I bet you that even though their vocalizations aren't that complex, I bet you their non-vocal communication is very complex.
I would agree with that hypothesis,
yeah.
Chris. Hoofstock in general,
yeah.
whenever I'm giving horse lessons or talking about
right.
horse behavior, I always talk about the two main forms of communication,
right.
verbal, of course, what sound does a horse make, but then the non-verbal
right.
in the horse world is way more important
right.
than the verbal.
Right.
I mean, you can read their body language and know a lot, pretty much a lot of what they're thinking, or be able to anticipate what their behavior
right.
is. And For me, it's second nature because I've been working with horses for 30 some years.
The last 80 and years so, of Angie's life.
Yeah. So, and in my previous life too. So, but yeah, no, but you bring up a really good point. And, you know, and I don't know how much research has been done on that, but I guarantee, especially between a mother and a calf.
Right.
Because she needs to talk to that calf all the time about what to do, what not to do, how to behave, how not to behave. But if she's not making all these vocalizations, she must be doing it in more
non-vocal ways.
Non-vocal ways, which, and I mean, I non-vocally communicate with my boys a lot. And I just look at them, I give them the stare with my lip kind of tightened.
Yeah. Like,
you better understand what I'm saying, son. So, yeah, us mothers have a lot of non-vocal communications that we do, and kids pick up on it.
Yeah, well, I was doing a lot of vocal communication yesterday morning driving out to that gorge because the boys weren't happy. Then at the end of the day, they're both laughing in the back of the car about how much fun they had. But no, so just benefit for the listeners real quick too. When we talk about non-vocal communication, think of body posture. In horses, it's easy. We look at the ears. We always say the ears are the barometer of the animal's mood. But in an okapi, it could be, you know, what's a threat behavior for them, which would be interesting because they're pretty docile. What would it be? But, you know, like a horse is either going to pin its ears and drop its head, get ready to bite you, or turn around where it's going to kick you. Yeah. So that could be something, you know, that an okapi would do, but non-vocal versus us who like yell, or a primate, you know, screaming as a vocal communication. So anyways, yeah, that was that. Interesting, really interesting stuff.
Well, and I think with okapis living under human care, I think some of the, of course, they care about their social behaviors, but one of the first things they wanted to study with these guys is what they eat and how best to feed them, and when they're not living in the Congo in the middle of Central Africa, how do we feed them in North America or in Europe?
Right,
that was a huge priority, and then secondly, the other priority, of course, is breeding them. What are the behaviors needed to make them happy so they can breed and so we can mimic their naturalistic behaviors in the wild? So, for instance, you're probably not going to see a lot of males and females together in a captive setting because that's not how they would be found in the wild.
Right.
Now you'll see moms and offspring together, maybe siblings together for a while, or females probably can be nice to each other together. So, but there's a lot to learn about these animals in order to take the best care of them, which is the number one goal of zoos and conservation centers. So that being said, we do know a lot about their nutrition because that was a very important thing to study.
Right, and it's made me think, you know, about your research, you know, and how it affects animals in captivity. You know, you're doing this phytoestrogen work and. I was actually bragging about you yesterday to not, you know, pat yourself on the back, but Angie's doing some incredible work that potentially has some really game-changing stuff for a lot of captive species. And so Jesse and I were talking about your work on white rhinos this weekend and how we thought, you know, bringing them to captivity and knowing their diets. So you're right. So with okapi...
You're making me blush, Chris.
It's amazing. You've worked very hard. So Dr. Adkins, very pretty quick. The nutrition's very interesting because it's so varied. It is, you know, they're a browser. So that means they like to eat plants, bushes, leaves. They eat fungus, some types of fungus, the fruit. They found them. They actually graze. They browse on ferns. And so over 100 different species of plants, which is insane.
It is insane. They're designed with that tongue to reach and pull up and grab whatever leaf they want. And interestingly enough, they're Africa's only ungulate that browse predominantly on the forest leaves.
Right.
So giraffes are going to browse more on the savanna type shrub leaves and trees. So it's pretty interesting. And they're ruminants, though. And that's very similar to cows, different than horses. Horses are not ruminants. Horses are considered monogastrics, like us humans. So they have one stomach. Whereas an okapi, or a cow, which is a ruminant, they have four chambers to their stomach and ferment right. grasses, chew cud, which is a very common behavior. Anybody who's observed cows, you can see them ruminating, right?
Right.
Chewing they basically regurgitate some of the grass they've eaten and re-chew it and then swallow it again.
Right. Yeah, and they're breaking down the particle size so they can digest it better. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to get whatever nutrients they can out of it.
And researchers do know that these over 100 plant species that the okapis are known to eat, some of them are poisonous to humans and other animals. They don't know how the okapis do fine with them.
Right.
That's, I guess, more studies later on in the future, but they do know that they do okay with it. And when researchers do fecal analysis, they find that of those 100 plant species, there's no dominant type of food. They'll eat, like you said, shrubs, mm-hmm. Fungus, fruits, grasses, lots of leaves and tree buds. And they right. eat up to 20 to 27 kilograms, or for me, 40 to 60 pounds a day. So that's a lot.
Wow.
That's a lot of food.
Yeah, they eat a lot. Yeah, that is a lot. And it was interesting, you're talking about the poisonous plants. I remember the white rhino episode, or the rhino episode, we talked about white rhinos able to eat some of those plants. And I think, you know, part of the rumen does protect animals from, like cows can eat moldy hay and
right.
survive.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good. It's not preferable. You don't want to feed an animal moldy anything, but they can eat moldy hay and the rumen will basically cleanse it for them so it doesn't kill them. Where you feed moldy hay to a horse, you're going to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
You can kill it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, some of these species that have evolved to be able to eat plants that might be poisonous to us or other animals. I did see a study where they eat clay to try to get some of their minerals.
Right. Their body knows what they need. And so they'll go down to the river basin and consume, probably while they're drinking water, consume some of this clay, which helps them meet their mineral nutrient requirements, which
is a
nice adaptation. But there's still a lot that we don't know. And when we're...
Oh, obviously, yeah.
When animal care specialists are trying to mimic their diets in a captive setting, there can definitely be some challenges as to... What do we feed these guys? Do we feed them hay? Do mm-hmm. we feed them leaves? Do mm-hmm. we feed them pellet mm-hmm. food? But in the past 20 to 30 years, they're doing a really good job of mimicking their diets to the best of the ability, and then also using enrichment to mimic how they get their food. So a lot of times you'll see it hanging up high, like in a hay bag, or leaves mm-hmm. tied up together on a line or up against a tree, to encourage that okapi to exhibit its natural behavior of browsing and being selective mm-hmm. for food.
Yeah, yeah. Zoos do a really good job. You know, the accredited zoos that have okapi do a really good job of hanging that stuff. As far as conservation status, these guys are endangered. Their population's decreasing, you know, 10 to 20,000 maybe in the wild. Don't really know.
It's tough. They're secretive. They live in a dense forest. They're mm-hmm. secretive. They camouflage into the foliage, and they mm-hmm. are only diurnal. So these estimates are the best guess.
Right. And I, you know, whenever we do these population analyses and we think about this, and I think of 10 to 20,000. So I think of, a basketball stadium or a hockey. I've been to a few hockey games, and that's about 15,000 people. So you imagine in that small arena, that's the entire population of that species.
Correct.
Not many. Now, if I'm dating myself going way back to the 80s, when I went to actually a Raider game, don't know how I survived the LA Coliseum at a Raider game, being a Charger fan, but there was 100,000 people in there, right? And that's still, that's huge, huge stadium. But if that's your entire population, even at that is tiny. For an entire species mm-hmm.
Live in a specific area, have pretty specific needs as far as diet go. It's not a high number at all. Especially
no.
10 years ago, they thought, or maybe more like 15 years ago, the estimates were at about 40,000. So mm-hmm. in that time, in 10 years' time, it's dropped drastically. So
Right.
I think that that's what's really concerning.
Right.
Let alone other, many, many other issues. It's very complex. Many other issues, including climate change, we touched on a little bit. But then, of course, the instability of the country and countries around it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's a lot of concern and a lot of push towards helping these guys out. And now in the Congo, under Congolese law, the okapi is a national symbol and they are fully protected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we all know that that doesn't stop poachers and and they're also not included in the CITES appendices either. So as far as international trade goes, there's really not much documentation about that. I suppose they must think because they're protected under Congolese law that they don't maybe don't need to be part of CITES. But they live in these forests, and forests we all know are being devastated due to logging and human settlement. Mm-hmm. And then okapi, and it makes some sense to me, but of course it's a hard pill to swallow, but they are extensively hunted for their bush meat and their skin.
Right. Yeah, the good news too, you're right about the Congolese, but they do have the Okapi Wildlife Reserve, and that was placed on the World Heritage Site list. So I know in my interview with Niaga, he was talking about Katbah. They're fighting to get Katbah in that region on the World Heritage Site list because that really pours in a lot of resources to protect that area of the world. So the Okapi, fortunately, are in that wildlife reserve. So they think it protects about 5,000. That's what the IUCN had written down about that. So that's good. That's good.
Mm-hmm. And that is good. And the other good news, too, is that in accredited zoos around the world, there are about 100 or so okapis living under human care, which really isn't a lot if you think about.
No.
They're at not a lot of zoos house them. They're at very selective zoos, special zoos. So, but there's still at least a population that's outside of Africa that potentially acts as a genetic bank or reserve.
Right. Right.
For what's happening over in the Congo. But
right.
With that being said, though, like a lot of large mammals that we've discussed on this podcast, they do have a very long life. They can live up to 30 years, 20 to 30 years, maybe 15 in the wild, depending. Males will reach maturity after 2 years or so, and similar to females, a year and a half to 2 years. So it takes them a little while to sexually mature. But then when a female does get pregnant, she's only going to give birth to one calf. Twins are very rare, similar to like horses.
Mm-hmm.
But she is pregnant for a very long time. Longer than I'd want to be pregnant, that's for sure.
9 months wasn't enough for you?
No. Or
9 months was geez, too much for you?
Yes, no. These poor okapi girls, they're looking at 13 and a half to 15 months.
Wow.
So a long time, time. And so they're not... They can have calves into older age, but you know, on a good cycle, they're maybe having calves every other year, maybe.
If
they can find a male, and then if they get pregnant and the pregnancy sticks, so their turnover time is slow, like a lot of large mammals, and with that comes the pressure of they're not able to reproduce quickly, and so when we're wiping out hundreds or thousands of years due to either poaching or deforestation, that's going to be really hard to rebound from that number.
Right, right. Yeah, it's sad with these large mammals because, you know, they're easier to hunt than smaller stuff. And it takes so long to get to adult stage, you know, and so many things have to go right. And it's not like, you know, where you see the thing that comes to my mind is wild pigs. You know, they breed, they have a litter, they mature within a year, they're breeding again, and, you know, your generation interval is very short, whereas something like an elephant or an okapi or a rhino or even some whales, you know, it takes a few years before, 2 to 3 years, you know.
Well, Chris, something else to think about is then a cute little adorable okapi is born, and if you haven't gone online and checked out either YouTube videos of a little okapi calf bouncing around, you are missing out because it is super precious. But what some of their natural behavior is that when the calf is born, of course it can walk pretty quickly, obviously, like a horse. But it, the juveniles or the babies are kept in hiding. The mom will den it down in like a little nest area, similar to maybe what deer will sometimes do. And then she leaves it there and goes out and forages for the day, or whenever she's, whatever her time, her foraging is. And so the offspring is left there very vulnerable. So just because an okapi gives birth to a healthy calf, it, there's infant mortality from predators. Right. A common predator to an okapi is going to be the leopard. Right. And so they don't always make, once they're born, they don't always make it. And it takes them, you know, a good 6 months to become a little bit more independent. And it can take, you know, and then they have to develop into adults and become independent. So it's not a fast life cycle. And we're still learning a lot about it, to how, right, how we, not only how to do it better in a captive setting, but how do we do it? How do we protect them more, even though they're in this protected space?
And right, right.
Interestingly, there's been a few different ways that researchers and zoological managers and veterinarians have explored of how to take care of okapi calves when they are living under human care, because they had noticed that the moms were either not taking care of the babies or taking care of the babies too much and using, right, that long tongue to overgroom them.
I can imagine.
Mm-hmm, which seems like cute, and moms do need to groom their babies, but if they overdo it, it could actually harm the offspring, mm-hmm, or harm the calf. And so this goes to show you how dedicated zoo staff and researchers are. Luckily, mm-hmm, when they're under human care, there's no leopards around the court.
Yeah.
So they're safe. But these are all things that people are learning to try to figure out how to take better care of them so they can be more successful, not only in a captive setting, but also so when they are in the wild or reintroduced into the wild, that they can live a more natural, healthy life. So it's just really, I really applaud the people that are behind a lot of the management, the trying to understand, mm-hmm, the management and the behavior of a species that we don't know a heck of a lot about, right?
We're
still learning. Some of the papers I was looking at were from 2017, 2016, as far as a lot of times in the researcher and zoo world will want to communicate with other scientists and animal managers and the best way to take care of these animals and their welfare, and there's, we're still working on it with a lot of the species, of course, but okapi, right, definitely.
I hope the listeners appreciate, because I'm really learning to appreciate this. Every species we pick, there are people around the world researching that species, fighting to save that species or group of animals like poison dart frogs, things like that. There are so many people out there doing so much great work that bravo to you. You know, Angie and I are just two voices.
I'm inspired in the crowd every week, Chris. I mean, yeah. You know, for instance,
it's incredible.
Oh, it's so incredible. It's so inspirational. Yeah. It really makes me love this this little part-time hobby you and I have going on.
Yeah.
In fact, this week I have, of course, my two organizations. But the first organization just like has blows my mind away. It's called the Okapi Conservation Organization. So you can find them at, mm-hmm, www.okapiconservation.org. They were established a little over 30 years ago in 1987 to, of course, protect the okapi in the Congo. Mm-hmm. And their focus is keeping these guys safe through wildlife protection mechanisms and also through learning. And so in 1987, the Okapi Conservation Project was initiated in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was then Zaire. And their main objective is obviously to protect the wild okapi. And as you had, mm-hmm, mentioned, Chris, they do this by reserving over 13,000 square kilometers of rainforest, okay? And it's, mm-hmm, it's a World Heritage Site. And, of course, that protects the okapis, plus elephants and primates, birds, amphibians, mm-hmm, all these, mm-hmm, other species under their umbrella. And they work with tons of European and American zoos and conservation organizations on how to provide care for them and how to learn what they've learned about them. And they work with the locals on how to be less destructive when they're farming. So a typical way to farm land in this region is what's called slash and burn. And so the Okapi Conservation Group, they've helped work with the farmers on a better practice, and they've provided over like 40,000 tree seedlings to replant some of the devastated forest areas.
Right.
They've taught the villagers how to use alternative crops like trees and fruits and vegetables and what's known as better farming methods or sustainable agriculture. And then within the community, they work with donors and partners to provide all these programs. They help out schools, health clinics, fresh water sources. They do emergency medical care. And they do all of this, Chris. And they've been doing this. They continue to do this. They do all this in the Congo, which, as you had mentioned, is there's often different clashes with with militia and
it's a tough place to live.
Yeah, different wars going on. And so in June 2012, the staff at the Okapi Wildlife Reserve were attacked, and they think it was retaliation for maybe turning in some poachers and doing their job, right? So they came and lashed back at them, attacked them, and they killed 6 guards, some more staff that was like volunteering there, and then they had a couple, they had over 14 Okapis too that they killed at the breeding center. So imagine, so that happens, okay?
Right.
And guess what that staff does? They dust their bootstraps off and they and built better measures to protect themselves and protect their animals, and they just keep on fighting the good fight. So like you said, when after reading that, it's horrible that happened to this group that are just trying to help these poor Okapi and the local community too, right? Giving the local, helping economically helping all the locals, and the locals love them. And still there, you know, there's just this group of bandit militias that are poachers that, you know, want to do bad things. And yet this group, the Okapi Wildlife, people say, you know what? We're going to keep doing what we do. And they do.
Keep going.
And they have so many success stories.
That's what makes this so amazing, is just there's people like that that are giving their lives up for the animals.
Yes, easily.
Yeah, it's insane.
Easily. And then, and so that rolls into my second organization of the week, that I've, of course, been wanting to talk about since we've started this podcast. But this group is near and dear to my heart. Our hearts. Yeah. It's a White Oak Conservation Center, and you can reach them at www.whiteoakwildlife.org. Of course, both these groups are on Facebook too, so please like them, reach out to them, send them messages if you want more information. But White Oak is an amazing conservation facility here in North Florida that, of course, promotes conservation through science, education, training, and collaboration. And they have over 16,000 acres of animals and people working together to help save these animals. And like you've mentioned earlier, some of the most endangered animals in the world, including the okapi, and they're just an amazing facility, great animal care staff, awesome education. They are not open to the public because that's how much they are dedicated to just doing what they do and doing it well. However, multiple times throughout the years, they'll open their gates up to the public so the public can learn about them, and they will do private tours. And they are working closely with okapi. That's one of their flagship species. They are learning how to provide optimal health, husbandry, and nutrition to the okapi so we can keep them around a lot longer. And of course, they work with groups in Africa, mainly the Okapi Conservation Organization. And they're just great ambassadors for how to take great care of okapi and how to also work overseas with their collaborators in order to promote conservation and other initiatives such as that. So go check out White Oak.
Right.
Their website's amazing. They do amazing things. They've helped me out a lot with some of my research. They want what's right for the animals' welfare and for science and learning more about them.
It's by far one of my, Angie and I have gone back year after year, one of our favorite places
it's
on Earth.
It's my happy place.
To go. I love every time I got to visit there. And, and we'll talk more with Jesse. That's where Jesse and I crossed paths years ago. Here we are meeting and becoming friends in New Zealand. But we had probably walked past each other at White Oak at some point years ago and didn't even know each other, which is just so funny.
And so for those listeners out there that have maybe clicked on the show notes or Googled a picture of the okapi and are still with us, A, bless your hearts, and B, wondering, well, geez, I can't go to the Congo. I'm not going to be able to help the okapi. There's many, many ways to help okapi from your couch. And one of the first ways is to share knowledge about okapis. I guarantee you, if you went and polled 10 of your closest friends, probably less than half have heard of an okapi.
Yeah, I don't even know what it is.
So you can spread or tell people about this podcast, show people, invite friends to like the White Oak conservation page about okapi,
right.
Or even better still, okapiconservation.org, their Facebook page. Invite your friends, get them to see this beautiful, unique animal. It's not a joke. It's not a hybrid of two species. This is a real animal that's in big trouble and they need our help. And another thing that's really, really critical, and I know you do this, Chris, and I do this in my family, but if you can recycle your old cell phones.
Right. Yep, that's a good one.
And you say, well, why not? Why? Well, they contain coltan, which is a mineral mined in the forest of the Congo. And if you recycle your phones, that's less of this mineral that's needed and less mining in the forest. And illegal mining is also devastating the okapi habitat of course, the okapis then too. So that's something anybody, I mean, we all get new phones like every year or every other year.
Right.
So just make, and there's recycling centers. Some companies even offer incentive for money or discounts. So recycle your phone.
Cool. And then just for us, if you could follow us on Facebook and Twitter, that'd be great. You can find us there, All Creatures Pod. Also, the links are on our website, so you can go www.allcreaturespod.com. That's where all the show notes are. The blog's been a little quiet lately, but I'll pick it back up once my container gets here. It's been 2 months without my desktop, but should be here next week, so I'll hopefully be back in business and much more productive than I have been, especially I'm enjoying New Zealand, so. But anyways, thank you for listening.
Thank you so much.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.